Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Hannah Colton, a reporter here at KUNM Public Radio. The Trump administration last week killed Iranian military leader Qasem Soleimani, along with others near a Baghdad airport. Iran responded to the assassination Tuesday by firing missiles on U.S. bases in Iraq. In a speech yesterday, President Trump said there'd been no casualties and vowed to punish Iran with more economic sanctions. This morning, we'll hear local perspectives on the growing U.S. conflict with Iran, and we'll dig into the history behind it. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about Trump's actions against Iran? Are you concerned about the possibility of more war in the Middle East? Give us a call. Phone lines are open now, 277-5866. You can also email us at letstalk@kunm.org. Again, 277-5866. I want to welcome in the studio this morning Amir Ali Shokralahi, a UNM undergraduate student who's from Iran. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Hannah.
And joining by phone is Dr. Emil Nakle, who runs the UNM Global and National Security Policy Institute. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So a lot of history to unpack here. We'll just start with General Qasem Soleimani, who was he? And in your opinion, Dr. Nakle, was Trump justified in calling him the, quote, world's top terrorist?
Thank you for having me. Qasem Soleimani was the head of the Quds Force within the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. He was a very powerful person. He has blood on his hands. There is no doubt about that. Some of that blood was spilled by Americans. But I think it's a stretch to call him the world's top terrorist. Unfortunately for us, we've experienced so many global terrorists, from bin Laden to Baghdadi of ISIS to Zarqawi of the Islamic State in Iraq. So there are, unfortunately, others who have such a title, but this is rather a stretch to call him the world's top terrorist as a justification for targeted killing him.
And I want to mention, too, that Trump, you know, said in his speech yesterday that there was an urgent need to kill Soleimani in order to prevent attack. He's presented no evidence, right, of that imminent attack.
Right. I am, of course, not privy to intelligence reports. I have not seen any since I left the government. But I would, if I were in Congress, I would want to see evidence of such a claim. It is rather spurious to claim that there was a huge plot to do something, yet without clear evidence to lawmakers. And you cannot just say, well, we have evidence, but we cannot share it. Of course, in some cases, you cannot share such evidence, but by law, you have to share it with the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee. So I'm a bit suspicious about the nature of such a claim.
We're talking this morning about the U.S.-Iran conflict, hearing local perspectives. Give us a call if you have thoughts this morning, 277-5866. Reports from Tehran showed streets packed with people there on the day of Soleimani's funeral, hundreds of thousands. Some said this showed that Iranians have unified around his death. Amir, when we talked, you were very skeptical of that kind of interpretation. Can you talk about why?
Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, the reports from Tehran on the day of Soleimani's funeral showed hundreds of thousands of people. Do you think it was a show of unification among the Iranian people, or what's your sense of what's going on?
It could be. I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure. Again, there are so many hands behind the curtains. The political talk is so complex. I think I am skeptical of that. I think that, you know, the entire funeral, maybe a lot of things these days have become about, you know, a show. So I think that could, you know, the news agencies showing that, it could also be a show that, you know, Soleimani was this big top guy. So
thanks, Amir. And I want to introduce also in the studio this morning, Mary, an Iranian-American living in Albuquerque. She's asked us not to use her name because her family could be targeted. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And what would you like to add about Soleimani and the role that he played in Iranian society?
Soleimani was a national hero. Yeah, he had been a national hero for about 20 years. He started early. In his youth, he had joined the sentiment of the Islamic Revolution. He then, when the Iraq War, shortly after the revolution in 1980 started, he was a soldier, and he rose quickly to the ranks, through the ranks, and his charisma was obvious, and to the point where he became a general. Now, after the completion of the war, the Iran-Iraq War, what happened was the Iranians that were in power in the government, they recognized that they not only needed to protect their powers inside of the country, they needed to protect their country from outside forces. So they decided to form a Quds power that would influence outside countries in the region to protect Iran. And this was easy to do because Iran is Shia, and Iraq is primarily Sunni, but it does have Shia following also. And the Shia, during the United States war, during Bush Sr., the Persian Gulf War, they were backstabbed in a way when President Bush Sr., after the completion of the 43-day war, allowed the Black Hawks, allowed Saddam Hussein to fly the Black Hawks and kill the Shia in southern Iraq. So the Shia in southern Iraq, who are a minority, they felt they also needed to be protected against whatever power might arise after Saddam Hussein. So for them, it was very easy to embrace an Iranian general who came in and was also Shia, and they felt protected. And other countries in the region also have a Shia minority, and Lebanon is also Shia. So it was easy for General Soleimani, with his charisma, with the power that he was given, to establish a following and establish a friendship with those, both in the Assad government and with Lebanon and with the Shia in Iraq. And the Iranians, even those, the Iranians who were not in agreement with the government of Iran, in a way they felt very protected because of General Soleimani. He was able to protect Iran against ISIS. You know, when ISIS rose in the region and it was targeting, you know, that there was kidnappings, there was mayhem, there was chaos, there was shootings, there was women being forced into marriages, there was mass graves, there was destruction. And General Soleimani was able to protect Iran from this chaos, and even the minorities in Iran, which were Zoroastrian, Christian, and we even have the largest population of Jews in the Middle East outside of Israel, they felt protected in a way because ISIS had targeted the minority religions in the region, the Christians, and General Soleimani protected Iran from the forces of ISIS and the chaos and the destruction in the region.
Thank you for that. And I want to dig more into the history before and since the time period that you're talking about. But Mary, you grew up in the U.S., spent about a decade in living in Iran, right?
Yes.
Can you talk about what that time was like for you, and what is what are these recent developments with the U.S. strikes and the and Iran returning? What does it feel like to you? I mean, what's top of mind for you?
So, I identify myself. You know, I love America. America is my country. I love Iran. Iran is my country. You know, Iran is my father country. The United States is my mother country, and I love them both. So, like, I would say, like a child of parents who don't get along very well with each other, that's kind of the feeling I have. I love America, I love Iran, and I love the people. And the thing that I have been able to understand as being both Iranian and both American is I have been able to easily separate the government from the people. I do not see the government as the same as the people, and the Iranian people have been able to make that differentiation also. So just like in the United States, a person can identify themselves as an American and as a patriot and as somebody who loves America, but not necessarily loves Obama. And just like someone who is an American and loves America and is a patriot, but doesn't necessarily love Trump, they are both Americans, and it is the same in Iran. As you know, there are Iranians who love Iran and they're patriots of Iran, but they may not necessarily love the government or agree with everything that the government is doing. So when I speak of Iran, I speak of the people of Iran. I do not speak of the government of Iran unless I say I'm speaking about the government of Iran. But when there is a conflict, there are some people in the United States who have a tendency to make Iran people who are both Iranian and American, whether by birth or naturalization, they see them as other. And so there is, you know, that there are some Americans who have that tendency. And just like whether it was the Japanese that were put in internment camps during World War II, or, you know, I think everyone who has been labeled as other when there is a conflict, you know, people need to be aware that just because somebody is born, has the blood of a different country, you know, that is not something to be feared. You know, it's something to be understood.
Thank you for that. And Amir, how has this affected you personally? I mean, when you hear talk of this like othering and sort of language that puts people into different categories that are unfair, like how has that affected you?
I mean, I moved here when I was in high school, so the culture shock was huge for me. And I can't imagine how it is for a lot of the PhD students that are out here in their 30s. Now they're in this culture, in this society, that hits them really hard.
I do want to take a listener question. We've got a couple listeners on the line. Jim is calling from Taos. Good morning, Jim. What would you like to add?
Good morning. I'd like to, I know you're going to dive into the history of the American-Iranian conflict a little bit. I'd like to jump on that real quick. The United States has a history, a very long history going back from our beginning of interfering in the business of other countries and other peoples and other cultures. We did it with the indigenous nations of North America. We've done it in South America, throughout the Caribbean, Asia, the Middle East, so on and so forth. We have a long history of this. And this interference in other people's business has repercussions definitely for the people in those countries, such as Iran, but also for our foreign policy. The United States overthrew a democratically elected prime minister in Iran in the early 50s, which set off many decades of conflict between the United States and Iran that still has an impact on our foreign policy. You know, that's over 50 years ago. You know, we did the same thing in Chile and you know, our support of the dictatorship in Cuba, you know, so on and so forth. And my comment is just that with the United States constantly messing in other people's business, we have repercussions for our foreign policy and for the people in those countries that are quite sad and tragic.
All right. Thank you so much, Jim. And we're going to touch on those things more after this quick break. You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM 89.9 FM. Back in a minute.
Support comes from the New Mexico Philharmonic, presenting Brass, Winds, and Bach's Air. The NM Phil plays Brass and Winds Masterworks, 3 p.m. Sunday the 12th at the NHCC. Tickets and info at nmphil.org.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. Rothsteinlaw.com.
For some tribes, winter is a time to tell stories and play games. Join us for the next Native America Calling as we take a closer look at traditional shoe games and moccasin games. They're not only for fun, they're community events and teaching tools that include traditional storytelling and language.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Hannah Colton. Today, we're talking about the U.S. conflict with Iran, which escalated this week after the Trump administration assassinated a top Iran military commander. Do you support U.S. intervention in the Middle East? Why or why not? What questions do you have about this current situation in Iran? Give us a call now, 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. You can also get at us on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And I want to take one more listener call before we go back to our studio guests. Sherry is calling from Albuquerque. Sherry, you're on air. What would you like to add?
Yes, thanks, Hannah. Well, I agree with Jim on what he was saying. You know, and it's just sad that Mr. Trump saw that initially when he got in, he could have done anything. But the first thing he started doing was dividing everybody. And that, you know, why does it make somebody else, him, look better if he points fingers at the other people? Now here we are with this situation that's all instigated by him. Same thing with the trade war, the tariff, tariffs anyway.
And what would you like to see happen, Sherry?
I would like to see happen. He was supposed to be this great negotiator. He still hasn't done it with the trades, negotiate something. He keeps saying he's going to, but then he's tweeting, oh, I'm going to have a meeting with China. He's just doing that to manipulate the stocks. But anyway, I would like to see him truly negotiate. He's never been over there, never talked to the people. And maybe it is time for us to get out of the Middle East. But the way he's gone about it with what he's done to the Kurdish people, abandoned them to be, you know, running for their lives and slaughtered. And now this, and then he expects them to add more sanctions. And we heard that it's not just the sanctions he's put on them already, but then he had his people go around the world and tell them, not bully them, to not buy the oil from Iran. So there's more to it than this person's doing. And I'm just sad of the state. And all these Republican Party, or majority of them, seem to be content on lying for him. And they hold positions of the highest order in our country. And for them to lie continually to the American people is just so upsetting.
Sherry, thank you so much for calling in. lot to unpack there. And if you do want to add to the program today, it's 277-5866. In the studio this morning, we have Mary, who's an Iranian-American living in Albuquerque. And as one of our callers mentioned, this crisis really dates back to 1953 when the U.S. and the U.K. overthrew Iran's democratically elected leader. Mary, why is it important for Americans to understand the history going back that far at this moment?
That was the beginning of things getting off on the wrong foot, if you will, to put it lightly. It was August 19th, 1953, when there was a CIA coup that overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh, who he wanted to nationalize the Iranian oil to empower his own country. And the thing about the oil was this was during a time when the United States government, it was Eisenhower at the time, he did not want Russia, because Russia is just north of Iran. It was about fear. He did not want the Iranian oil to be in the hands of Russia. And before it was in the hands of the United States, it was ruled by the British oil companies. So that's where things got off. I would say they brought in the Shah brought back the Shah to rule the country as a monarchy.
Who was in place until 79, right?
That is correct. And I think, the Iranian, it was not only about the oil, it was about opening the markets of the Iranian markets to the westernized goods. And there was also a huge cultural conflict. So whether, let's say, the cultural conflict arose from the fact that Iranian culture was not congruent with what was happening at that time. Iranian culture, women are traditionally more modest, and mini skirts were being brought in, and there was the cultural conflict. Alcohol, it was not something that was as prevalent. Bars and cabarets were not as prevalent in Iran. So there was a cultural clash, and when I had spoken to Iranians who were young at the time, they said, "Well, there are things about the American culture that we love, and that's what we want to see grow in Iran. The education system. They did not want a bar on every corner. They wanted more libraries, and what the changes that were taking place in Iran at the time were not congruent with the Iranian tradition and culture as much, and they were not respectful of the Iranian traditions and culture."
And Amir, you were kind of nodding along. What do you think many Americans really misunderstand about Iranians or about Iranian culture?
I think Mary mentioned this as well, as the separation of government and people in the first place. And it's the fact that the students here are really thankful for the resources they have. I thank the education administrations here, the universities, decades before me, now, and hopefully in the future, that have supported us and to stay and study here. And I would like to mention the sanctions have put so much pressure, not only on people in Iran currently, but students here being able to pay the tuition. They're not able to pay the tuition. The currency exchange rate is just ridiculous. And there's just so much pressure on the families there with the sanctions. The arts, sports, education is getting hurt in Iran by the sanctions. And just the fact that there's a beautiful side of Iran, that you don't ever get to see on the news, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Anything to add about the economic sanctions? I mean, people call it economic war. Yeah, Mary?
Well, with the nuclear peace treaty, when Trump left the nuclear peace treaty, which was very hard earned, because of the decades of mistrust that Iranians had toward the United States government. You know, this was something that was very hard to achieve. And also the United States government did not have complete trust of the Iranian government. So that was something
and,
that
sorry,
was
you're talking
hard-earned.
About the nuclear deal that was passed in...
Right. I like to say peace treaty because
gotcha.
It did keep the peace. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's my own label for it.
And Iran has the Iranian government has completely abandoned, like, the rest of the provisions of that since Trump ordered this assassination.
Well, they're not held to that anymore.
Mm.
They, you know, and it actually they started leaving it a year after. They held out for a year and then they started leaving it a year after. So, you know, in order to keep peace in the region, that was a necessity because now Iran is, you know, the United States left the, you know, Trump left the treaty, and then he imposed very difficult economic sanctions. So the Iranians are not motivated to come back to the table because he broke their word, his word, you know, the United States, you know, something that was signed by Obama, something that was signed by a United States president. So, and it was in writing, and it was in agreement with the other international countries. So, you know, they cannot, there's no way to trust whatever Trump will say at this point. There's no trust. The trust is completely broken. Just 2 days before the Soleimani assassination, Trump said that he loves peace. And so, you know, that, and then there was the Soleimani assassination. So, you know, they don't see what Trump says as something that is true or valid.
Mm. And he does lie frequently. Dr. Emil Nakle from the UNM Global and National Security Policy Institute is on the line. Thanks for being with us. And I want to ask you a question about that nuclear deal or that peace agreement, as we've heard. Trump called for the UK, Germany, France, Russia, and China to also break away from that. Dr. Nakle, how worried should we be about that right now?
I think this is a worrisome development because the P5+1, which is the nuclear deal that was signed by the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany, and that was to limit Iran's enrichment, uranium enrichment, which would lead to a nuclear weapon. The deal was one of the most promising arrangements that the international community has done with the Middle East for years. And it was negotiated not only by our Secretary of State, but also by our Secretary of Defense. By our Secretary of Energy and the scientists at the national labs. So they knew that we were putting limitations and intrusive inspection systems on Iran, the like of which the international community has not known before ever. In other words, we put a very intrusive inspection system on the nuclear activity in Iran, and Iran lived up to those limitations and restrictions according to frequent reports by the International Atomic Energy Commission. And what happened was that President Trump decertified that agreement because he did not like Iran to remain within the fold. He basically pushed Iran in toward abandoning the agreement. Iran has not, as was pointed out, has not abandoned the agreement, but has now freed itself from the limits of enrichment. That is what is worrying me in that if they go up from 3% to 5%, ultimately to 20% of enrichment, which is the threshold for producing nuclear weapons, it seems to me that President Trump's actions have led to this point. So when the Secretary of Defense said the other day that killing Soleimani was a game changer, I would take issue with that. The game changer wasn't really the killing of Soleimani, but it was the decertification of the nuclear deal. That is Trump's decision last year, I mean, in 2018, to decertify the nuclear deal. That put a whole host of processes in action because of the consequences that have emerged, not only from that breaking that deal, but also from the killing of Soleimani. And when you look today at the unintended consequences of that action in four or five areas, you will conclude that none of them serves the interests of the United States, despite what the president has claimed. He has his assassination of Soleimani has truly unified the Iranian people, has brought Iran and Iraq closer together, and has helped ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other Sunni radical groups to reemerge, and in fact has not cowed Iran into submission. And that is what is worrying me, not any one action, but a whole context of unintended consequences, which policymakers, especially the president, did not consider before decertifying the nuclear deal and before assassinating Soleimani.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico. The number to call in this morning is 277-5866. We've been hearing from Dr. Emil Nakle of UNM. And let's take a caller. Jeff has called in from Albuquerque. Can we get Jeff on the line? Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
What would you like to add this morning?
Well, from a standpoint of a 100% disabled vet who also performed the duties of a casualty reporting officer, meaning direct notification in person to the next of kin, I just want to add, when it comes to the unnecessary issues and conflicts that could potentially come up, you will never know the effects that it's having on our veterans. Right now, we're at a very high level of suicide rates as far as the veterans that have been exposed to combat. And even though you may think everybody's trained and we're all trained, we're all subject to some of the problems associated with being exposed to that type of violence when you're in a conflict area or something happens like bombs go off. Secondly, there is nothing else, and this is the last thing I want to say, like walking up with a notification team telling a mother, a father, a wife, a spouse, we're sorry to inform you of the untimely death of your fill in the blank. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you for that, Jeff. And I do want to say, if this conversation is bringing up any difficult issues for folks, difficult emotions, I want to point you to the New Mexico Warm Line. That's 1-855-466-7100. And we have some more resources on our webpage for today's show on KUNM.org. And I want to welcome to the show another guest in the studio here, Monique Salhab, who spent 10 years in the military. She's now a veteran for peace. And Monique, what are you thinking about after hearing this last caller?
Thanks for having me here. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate Jeff calling in, and I appreciate him lending, I think, a very human aspect to war itself. And I would also add that with what he stated about notification, we cannot forget what happens as well to the children, the women, the families of the countries that the United States continues to wage war upon. I did two tours in Iraq, and what I can say that I witnessed was utter destruction, utter dehumanization of people. And I can speak that the military, what the military does well, the U.S. military, is that it dehumanizes. And in order for us to function in the U.S. military, we have to dehumanize ourselves. And I want to thank Mary for pointing out that, you know, the other, you know, we create a narrative here in the United States of the other and what the other represents, the quote-unquote enemy. And I think this is a narrative, whether it's this current administration or previous administrations, this is a narrative that since 9/11 has been amplified to such a degree that we forget what individuals in our communities who are Muslim from Middle Eastern countries, what they have to endure as individuals along with their family members. I am a first-generation American, Middle Eastern descent. I am not a practicing Muslim, but I can speak to what I experienced when I was deployed to Iraq and what I experienced from fellow soldiers who discovered my heritage. I was looked at as a pig. I had that said to me. And so, you know, I as I stated, it's a narrative that is very, very strong in this country. And we have to look at how we as human beings look at one another, especially in crises like this.
Thanks for that, Monique. We are talking about the U.S. Conflict with Iran this morning. Give us a call if you want to add in, 277-5866. You can also find us on Twitter. Use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Let's go to a quick break.
Jeff Nuttall told the audience in Charleston, South Carolina, that he has some feelings about this music.
This is a totally selfish and slightly guilty pleasure.
And he gets to play it alongside his best musical friends. Find out what's getting Jeff Nuttall all worked up on the next performance today from 8 p.m.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, the story of the first registered Mexican-American Holocaust survivor.
If you look at my dad in those years, you could not tell he had gone through anything that was extreme in nature because he hid his PTSD so well.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. Our show today is about the U.S. conflict with Iran. What do you think about U.S. military presence in the Middle East? Do you work on military contracts here in New Mexico? We'd like to hear from you. Our phone lines are open for another 20 minutes or so. 505-277-5866. I have in the studio today Amir Ali Shokralahi, a UNM student. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Hannah.
And Monique Salhab, a veteran for peace.
Thank you.
And Mary, who's an Iranian-American living here in Albuquerque. And we're coming up on the third anniversary, as Monique pointed out to me, of Trump announcing a Muslim ban restricting travel from certain places. We've heard recently about Iranian-Americans being detained at the U.S.-Canada border. Mary, how do these things and general discrimination and hatred against Muslims, how do these affect you and people that you know?
Well, I reference history when I want to analyze this, and I'd like to point out that throughout history, whether it was when the Europeans arrived, first arrived to what is what is now America, and they came upon the Native Americans. There were some of those who had the mindset of, oh, the Native Americans are less than they are, because they dress differently, their customs are differently, they look different. And they had a label for Native Americans. You know, at that time, they referred to them as with a derogatory word, which I will not say.
Yeah, a lot of violence against Native Americans,
right,
too.
Right, they labeled them. And so when you take a look at what was said, what was done, you know, the Native Americans, they had a resource, which was the land. And in order to dehumanize them, they labeled the Native Americans with a label which I shall not mention. And the same was done, let's say, to Hispanics. The Hispanics were also at some point, you know, they were seen and treated as less than. And also the African Americans, they also had a label, and the resource that was stolen from them was the free labor. And that also extends to what is happening now, the language. You know, the first step to dehumanizing a people is coming up with a label for them. So the label that is for Muslims or Iranians is terrorists. And that word is used in order to dehumanize the Iranian people and to just group them all as one and to dismiss their humanity and their human rights and for them to be treated as a human being. So, and the resource, of course, that Iranians had was the oil. So for instance, there are countries in the world that do not have valuable resources. And you don't see conflicts between the United States and those countries. So, for instance, Costa Rica abandoned its army in 1945, and it doesn't have an army. Well, it doesn't need an army because it doesn't have any superpower that is coming to exploit its resources. Its resources are coffee, its resources are bananas, and its resources are tourism, and that's what makes, you know, the country, you know, that what those are the resources of the country. So they don't need to have that.
Mary, I'm going to pause you for a second. To your point about the labels, President Trump yesterday, you know, used the word hatred, you know, mayhem, all of these really
strong
over-the-top vocabulary,
right,
and called Iran the, quote, leading sponsor of terrorism. Mm-hmm. And Iran's parliament just passed a bill designated the U.S. military forces also as terrorists. So my question is, what does that sort of mean for the troops who are there now or who may be soon? Mm. Monique, do you have ideas? I mean, if you're stationed in a country, mm-hmm. the country declares that you are a terrorist. Mm-hmm. How does that affect you?
I think a couple of things. I think what the parliament did yesterday was revolutionary, because it's the truth. The fact is that the United States military is a terrorist. We have been a terrorist for decades. What I can speak to, I think, emotionally, mentally, to hear that as a veteran, you know, I will admit, slightly painful. You were taught when you go into the military, you were taught a job, a specialty. You are trained specifically in that specialty. That is what you do 24/7. And so therefore, you go in with a certain mentality of what you have been told and view as the enemy. And so, you know, and in some ways, you know, a ruling like that may help the mental capacity for a soldier to do his or her job. But I will say that, you know, there are many, many men and women in the United States military who do not agree with what is being done, what is happening. But it is not easy to speak up and say, I'm not going to carry a weapon. I'm not going to kill someone. There are repercussions for that. And so for myself, as a personal experience, I can speak to the many, many times that I struggled with carrying a weapon, the many times I struggled with knowing that I did not agree with what I was doing, did not believe in what I was doing, but saw it as my job. And so a piece that I want to touch upon is that, you know, when veterans come back, you go through, whether a veteran realizes it or not, is this moral injury. You know, we are taught as human beings right and wrong and how to treat people. And so when you go and you dehumanize someone, it is very difficult to try to reconcile your actions compared to what you have been taught and what mainstream society views as right and wrong.
Thank you for that. We have a few listeners on the line. I want to take a couple in a row here. Sarah is called in from Albuquerque. Sarah, you're on the line.
Great, thank you. I wanted to call and say this is an excellent discussion. I really appreciate it. And everyone has been amazing. And I really appreciate Amir and Mary for their bravery in speaking. I am opposed to the war in Iran, and I feel like the majority of the United States is. I know today 320 cities are having protests against the war in Iran, including in Albuquerque at 5 o'clock at San Mateo and Gibson. And I have friends in Iraq, and this kind of reckless action that's happened is endangering millions of people's lives in Iraq, Iran, and the U.S. military. And my friends in Iraq have asked me, are people opposing this? And I was able to send them photos that on Saturday, there were two protests in Albuquerque against the war, one in Santa Fe, one in Las Vegas, one in Peñasco, and across the country. And it's important for people to know, like, where Americans are on this. And I think the majority understand that the only ones who benefit from this kind of violence are corporations and some politicians.
Thank you for that, Sarah. And I did cover a demonstration that was organized by the Red Nation student group that was downtown, maybe about 60 people gathered. Julian Trujillo was among local organizers at that demonstration, and I want us to listen to a clip from him.
That's what break the war machine is, not only in the streets, but in our jobs. If your employer is looking at a U.S. military contract, tell them no, no more contracts. We will not support the U.S. military industrial complex. That's how we break ICE. That's how we break the Department of Homeland Security. That's how we break their terror on our communities, is by standing up and saying, no, enough is enough.
I want to put the idea of demonstrations and this pushback to Mary and Amir. I mean, does it help you at all to know that there are people pushing back? Do demonstrations like this make a difference? Do you feel any particular way about it?
Well, I view these demonstrations as an American. It makes me proud that there are people who actually know what's going on. There are people who are peace-minded. They don't get caught up in the emotions that are trying to be sold to them of being angry and, being having hatred toward and targeting a certain group of people, whoever those people are. Not only as an American, but as a global citizen, because I think the way our planet is right now, is we can't afford more war and destruction. We cannot afford more rising climate temperatures that are resulted from war. And I think we need to have a big reality check as human beings and focus on what the priorities are at this time. And the priorities should be avoiding war and taking care of each other.
Amir Ali, any thoughts?
It actually makes me feel proud to be a student studying in the United States, that, you know, people actually value, my nation, either Iraqis, Iranians, Syrians, that they value their lives. You know, about 2 months ago, there were protests in Iran. About 1,500 people were killed.
By the Iranian government.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. And And as a student, I would like to mention that a lot of the students who had their visas, they had funding for their research to come here, absolutely lost all communication with the professors at UNM or all across the nation because internets were shut down. There's no way of, you know, following up on their applications. And actually, a lot of them lost their, you know, research. They can no longer come here to study because they had a certain time period to move here, get things moving. But I would like to also mention, you know, studying in the United States is a melting pot of cultures. It has such great potential to grow in. I'm a part of the Iranian Student Association at UNM, and it's such a great growing experience for me as an undergrad. Even if the people of the United States could realize what level of intellect immigrants are bringing into the country, and I'm an undergrad speaking, imagine what a PhD student can do with their degree in the United States.
Let's take one more listener call. Don from Albuquerque. Got about 30 seconds.
Yes, I strongly compliment your guests today. And back to the Shah for a moment that the U.S. CIA installed. His secret police murdered up to 60,000 Iranians and tortured many more. How would we feel if another nation overthrew our government, installed a brutal dictator who murdered and tortured many of us? And as a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War who did alternative non-military service, I have paid no federal income tax, not one bloody penny for 41 years. Almost half of federal income tax goes for U.S. wars, past, present, and future. I live well, far below the U.S. federal income taxable level.
Thank you for that, Don. And later today, the U.S. House of Representatives is expected to vote on a measure to block Trump from more military action against Iran without congressional approval. New Mexico's congressional delegates have all said they support it. Dr. Emil Nakle on the line from UNM Global National Security Policy Institute. What do you think about that that congressional action? Is it going to be effective? Is more action needed to prevent escalation of conflict?
Yeah, I think the U.S. Congress should reaffirm the War Powers Act so that the president, before any future military action, should come to Congress. I mean, this is a very important step. But in reality, the executive has always invoked national security issues and proceeded with military action that was later reported to Congress. So while this action is important today by Congress, I'm afraid it does not limit the hands of the executive over time.
That is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much to our guests, Monique Salhab, Emil Neklon, Amir Ali Shokrolahi, and Mary. And thank you to everyone who called in. We had so many questions for our very expert guests today, and we didn't get to all of them, but the conversation doesn't have to end here. You can comment on our Facebook page, tag us on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM, or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. If you missed part of today's show, you can listen on kunm.org or subscribe to our podcast via iTunes. Tune in next Thursday for a look back at the year in news and at what's to come during the state's 2020 legislative session. That's next Thursday at 8. Our engineer is the wonderful Marino Spencer. Nash Jones live tweeted the show. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Marisa DeMarco is our executive producer. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM 89.9 FM.